Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Mutual Fund Observer conversation with Matthew Page and Ian Mortimer of Guinness Atkinson. All participants will be in a listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To ask a question, you may press star and then one. To withdraw your question, you may press star and two. Please also note that today's event is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference call over to Mr. David Snowball. Sir, please go ahead.
Great. Thanks, Jamie. And hello, everyone. Welcome to our conversation with Matthew Page and Ian Mortimer, the guys that are managers of the Guinness Atkinson Global Innovators and Guinness Atkinson Dividend Builder Funds, the latter formerly known as the Inflation Managed Dividend Fund. Chuck Jaffe, in a recent column, highlighted some intriguing research from the folks at AthenaVest. Their research suggests that most equity fund managers are actually able to do a better job of assembling a portfolio than you'd imagine. By their calculation, about 90% of all active managers can outperform their benchmarks, or would, except for two nagging factors. The most obvious are expenses of operating the fund, but even allowing for such expenses, about 80% of managers have the skill to outperform their benchmarks. But of course, they don't. They don't because of a series of self-inflicted injuries that the study's authors refer to as the portfolio tax. The tax is the drag imposed by three decisions. First, the decision to become too big. Second, the decision to trade too often. And third, the decision to seek shelter in the herd. Collectively, those decisions sabotage the vast majority of managers. The Observer tries to find the others. We cover primarily the universe of funds that are off of Morningstar's radar. We write for intellectually curious, serious investors, managers, advisors, and individuals who need to go beyond marketing fluff and computer-generated recommendations. We try to help you identify funds that matter. We think that describes the funds managed by Messrs. Page and Mortimer. Our plan is to devote the first third of our hour together to an introduction to the sort of strategy and philosophy behind the funds, the middle third to my chat with Matthew and Ian, and then the final third to your questions. Good afternoon, gentlemen. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, David, and thank you for inviting us to have this call with you and your readers.
I was wondering if you'd introduce yourself, since the folks can tell which voice is which, and perhaps tell us a bit about what the strategy, the underlying strategy is about and what you folks are up to.
Sure. So this is Matthew Page, and why don't I give you a quick introduction, and I'll hand over to Ian to introduce himself and to talk further. But I think the initial thing we really wanted to talk about today was this question of, you know, why innovation matters. We produce a global innovators fund, and it's a multi-cap global growth fund, and we look at trying to identify companies through this prism of innovation. And so we really wanted to just, you know, briefly address four questions. Firstly, you know, why are innovative companies an interesting investment opportunity? Secondly, how do we define an innovative company? There are many different ways of thinking what innovation is, so we want to explain that in some detail. Thirdly, you know, aren't innovative companies just all quite expensive? And fourthly, are the most innovative companies the best investments? So to that first question, why are innovative companies an interesting investment opportunity? Well, we think you want to invest in, you know, innovative companies because these are companies that are going to be doing something smarter, something cleverer, something better or more efficiently than the average company in, say, their industry. And the way that really translates ultimately is into higher return on capital. That is the key for us for everything that we do. It's all about return on capital. And you know, when we think about innovative companies, you know, we can find them at various different stages of a company's life cycle. We take a very broad approach to it. We aren't purely looking for those disruptive early stage growth companies. which can sometimes be very good investments. They can be very exciting. They can be very dynamic. They can have a great narrative towards them. You can feel extremely clever when they go right, but you can also feel extremely stupid when they go wrong. So, you know, we really break it down into two key areas. Obviously, we're not investing in those privately listed, very early stage companies. We're really looking at companies that are going through a more sort of rapid profitable growth phase, where maybe their returns on capital aren't yet showing through as being particularly high, but we strongly feel that they've got the potential to do so in the not too distant future. And then a second group of companies that have really proven themselves already, and they are now using or enabling innovation to maintain their market edge. Now, clearly not all companies that have a sort of sustainably high return on capital will necessarily be innovative. They may simply have some sort of monopolistic or duopolistic competitive advantage, but a group of them will be, and those are the ones that we are, you know, seeking to identify. So in terms of that second question, you know, how do we define an innovative company? There's really, in our minds, two dimensions to describing an innovative company. The first dimension is the level of that innovation. So the way to think about that is the company at the disruptive early stage end of the spectrum, or is it more at that sort of continuous incremental end of the spectrum? So, you know, if you think of a disruptive, it's quite easy to think of disruptive early stage companies like Tesla or Facebook or Netflix maybe a few years ago. But at that continuous end of the spectrum, we think there's plenty of companies like you know, Intel, for example, that are maybe mature, maybe quite boring, maybe not that interesting, maybe they're on hard times and there isn't a strong narrative behind them. But when you get under the bonnet, there's clearly something very innovative and potentially an interesting investment opportunity. So that's the first dimension. And then the second dimension is, what is the driver of that innovation? Innovation is not just technology. It is not just, you know, discoveries in healthcare and biotech. We think that can be a big part of it, but also new products or new services is a part of that. Similarly, a new business model. You know, what Netflix did was really bring together things that already existed, you know, in a new way. You know, if you think about it, the U.S. postal system was a key part of their business model. That was founded by Ben Franklin. You know, the first web page was introduced in 1991. You know, DVDs were introduced in 1996. So it was the way that they packaged that together, you know, into a new business model that really enabled that company to take off and generate high returns on capital. So I'll hand it over to Ian Mortimer now to discuss the other two points.
Hi, everyone. Ian Mortimer here. Very nice to speak to you. And really, I was going to ask the next two points is, you know, aren't innovative companies just expensive? And secondly, are the most innovative companies the best investments? Yeah, and I think with regards to the expensive nature, I think that comes in quite a lot to what Matt was saying about, you know, when you think innovation, or when certainly we mention it, people immediately jump to that very disruptive early stage companies. And you can look at things like Twitter on 135 times at expected earnings, or Facebook on 40 or 50, depending what the market thinks, and say, well, yes, they do seem very expensive. Some other interesting data points we saw last year in the United States was the number of IPOs. There's about 180 IPOs. Of those, only about a third, so 60, were actually profitable. When we then look at those profitable 60, we only find six or seven that had a PE of less than 20 times. And then when we look into those six or seven, you only found one that actually had what we would describe as a good sort of return on capital profile. And when we look at that one with a good return on capital profile, it actually had a debt to equity greater than 300%. So, you know, of all of those, we would say, you know, none of that is something that we would necessarily consider investing in. But it also shows you that that potentially disruptive bucket, at first glance, if you like, are expensive. But to Matt's point again, though, is that, you know, that's really only looking at a very small sort of subset of what we would describe as innovative companies. If we move out across the spectrum, so through those companies that are maybe accelerating in terms of their sort of innovation profile, or those that are more mature and are making sort of more incremental changes, we actually see a lot better value. So a recent example, you know, example we might suggest over time would be if you think of Intel. So, you know, Intel 25 years ago would be a quite expensive, very disruptive company. Maybe 10 or 15 years ago, you could describe it as accelerating. And today, it's more in that sort of incremental bucket, and then potentially offering better value. Companies we've bought more recently, which we would describe as innovative, could be something like a Boeing or maybe a Cisco. And we would place them in the more accelerating bucket for sort of Boeing, but maybe more incremental for Cisco. So it's also that idea of, you know, companies being innovative on a more incremental scale that allows them to maintain their market share or maintain their higher return on capital beyond the sort of the competition of peers. And I think for us, that's a very interesting place to look. The other thing to note as well, as Matt said, is that, you know, are the most innovative companies the best investments? And the thing we try and point out is, in our fund, we are not trying to put together a portfolio of the most innovative companies in the world. Rather, we're using that lens of innovation to find good growth companies. And I think it's that ability to find good growth companies is extremely difficult. And what we do is we then try and apply a value discipline to stock selection. So as an example, you know, something like, you know, Tesla was a company we looked at for the fund maybe 2 years ago. You know, maybe it was trading on about $30 or $40 then. When we looked at it, we analyzed the company. We thought it's very obviously innovative. You know, we thought they had, you know, good products, but it was very expensive. And what was hard for us to get our head around was how you could the amount of money you'd have to pay up for that expected growth in the future was extremely high in our opinion. And what we think is that there's a very high risk to investing in those types of companies with huge amounts of growth bedded into their current price. What we see is for something like Tesla, you remember the ones you got wrong. So, you know, we could look at Tesla at $200 and think, you know, gosh, isn't that a shame we didn't make five times our money? But what we would suggest is if you look at 100 or 200 companies like that with those high embedded growth prospects, that actually the balance of probability is unlikely that most of those will come through. And we think it's a fool's errand to try and then think you're clever enough to select, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 4% of companies within those 200 that might then go on to make five times your money. We would much rather in our portfolio run companies where, or buy companies where we can see the earnings, that the growth expectations are reasonable, and that we don't have to pay up too much for those. You know, we are not running a portfolio whereby we make 10 times our money on a couple of stocks and maybe a few of them go bust and hopefully the ones in the middle do okay. You know, we don't think that's a sustainable approach to investing over the longer term. One of the things we find as well is in terms of that innovation is that those earlier stage companies, today we don't see huge amounts of value there. If you look at our portfolio today, we own relatively little or almost none, we would suggest, in that bucket. And they're very hard to come by. Companies that are highly disruptive, innovative companies that trade on reasonable valuations. What we would rather do is avoid that sort of hype cycle. So company comes to market, everyone's very excited, people think it's going to do amazing. After a while, often what we see is that those companies don't do as well as people think. Therefore, their companies get re-rated, they become cheaper, but maybe they're still good companies. And it's at that sort of point where our value discipline comes in that we would then maybe select those. But ultimately, in terms of our fund, we very much believe in some of the things David said at the beginning, in terms of trying to build a portfolio so that we sort of create sort of effective barriers to some of those behavioural biases that can exist to be a drag on performance. So specifically, herd mentality. You know, we run a pretty concentrated portfolio. We typically have 30 companies in our fund. And we equally weight them, so they're all around the 3% level. This means we are very different to our benchmark, and all the stocks we own can add significantly to performance. Our active share versus the MSCI World is over 94%. So we are not, you know, we are making ourselves believe in all our positions. The other thing we do is have a very low turnover. We typically hold positions for between 3 and 5 years. So we're very much believers in that sort of buy and hold mentality. We are not sort of traders, if you like, and we are not churning the portfolio. And I think that really comes down to, you know, to sort of sum it all up, if you like, is that we are not big believers in trying to predict the future or forecast what the next big thing is. But we are believers in that innovative companies should perform better than their peers and for a longer period. But they're not necessarily a good investment at any price. What we really think is if you can find these innovative companies and you can buy them on a reasonable valuation, then that's a really quite a powerful combination. And that's what we're trying to do here. So it sounds easy in practice, but you know we've built up this process over the last 10 years, and we think we're doing a pretty good job. It's getting potentially more difficult in today's market with price rises and valuations generally, but we think the combination of that innovation but at reasonable prices and having a value discipline, buying and hold, and having a reasonable low turnover, all of which sort of add to our ability to, hopefully to continue that performance. So with that, I think I would say, we'd be very welcome to open it up to questions, and we've seen some of them on the bulletin board already, and they all look very interesting. So maybe, David, I could pass it over to you for questions.
Sure. Can you hear me, Matthew?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, good. The mute button on my phone doesn't have an indicator light anymore, so I'm not always sure when you can and can't hear me. A few background questions, if I could, about the Global Innovators Fund, and then I thought we would take at least a moment to say a word about the very small second fund that you folks have run also very successfully. But if we start with trying to think about the global innovators, how do you find them? I mean, a number of my readers point out that this is a lot like, endorsing mom or apple pie or baseball. No one opposes the idea of finding innovators. Everyone wants to find them. How do you actually do it?
Okay, so there's two key parts to it. If you think back to those sort of two core stages, the sort of earlier stage growth, smaller market cap group of companies, for that group, what we're doing is, we understand that these types of companies are hard to find. They're hard to identify which companies are going to be successful, which companies aren't going to be successful. So we are looking for a third-party citation of this company being innovative. We're not looking for them to say it's a good investment. We're just saying we want a third party who probably knows a bit more about the particular industry or sector than we do to say this company is innovative. So we would look at a whole range of, journals, magazines, could be anything really, but give you some examples. We look at MIT Technology Review. They produce a list of 50 innovative companies. It might be something as simple as, a company we found in Fast Company magazine or something like that. And so we produce a list of these companies, and there's about 200, 250 today. But what's important to note is, as Ian was sort of alluding to there at the end, is we often don't invest in those companies when we first identify them because of this hype cycle. Often when we first identify them, they are at their most hyped up stage because we're finding them in, the broad media, and therefore, often that is there's a sort of last people to identify these interesting companies. So what we tend to do is we'll tend to see is that these expectations normalize over the next 12, 18, 24, sometimes even 36 months, where something will go wrong, and expectations go from being overly optimistic to potentially overly pessimistic. And so it would be at that stage that we would start to get interested in those types of companies. So that's the first group. The second group then is looking for companies that have already proven themselves to generate high return on capital. So we actually run a more sort of quantitative screen here, actually looking back over a 10-year period for companies that have generated a top quartile return on capital in each of those 10 years. And it's quite a sort of ruthless screen, really. It knocks out 95% of companies that are listed globally around the world. And then from those that subset of companies, obviously not all of those will necessarily be innovative. They will be potentially, have these sort of competitive advantages which you wouldn't necessarily describe as being innovative. But when we look through those group of companies, it's interesting to find that, you know, as we were sort of alluding to earlier, you know, these companies exist in most sectors. Okay, you won't probably find an innovative utility, or if, you know, if there is one out there, let us know, because we haven't found it. But across the other sectors, it's actually a pretty evenly spread group of companies.
Okay. And you noted that you use a return on capital screen. They have to be in the top 25% for return on capital in each and every one of the preceding 10 years, not just for the 10-year period. But you know, too, that some of those are successful because of other factors. They're in a monopoly or a duopoly or whatever. How do you use the same mechanism then to figure out among those firms which are innovators and which are not, or is there a separate discipline than what you use for the disruptors?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, we're very aware of that. So I think one of the key things to note first is that, as Matt described those, you know, we find the Group 1 companies, third-party recommendations. We find the Group 2 companies more from this quantitative method. Neither of those things mean that the company goes into our portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, what we've tried to do is identify an investable universe, first of all. And that investable universe will include very disruptive, very innovative companies, maybe some companies that aren't so innovative, et cetera, et cetera. Companies that are very expensive, companies that are very cheap. So that's quite a big pot. Today, that investable universe is around the sort of 500 level, as Matt said, split roughly 50-50 between those Group 1 and Group 2 companies. What we then do is, when we spend most of our time doing, is then filtering down that, mainly number one, looking for valuation. But number two, we also, when we look at a company, we analyze why it is innovative. So we've created this sort of matrix idea whereby we look at each individual company and decide what's its level of innovation. So is it very disruptive? Is it accelerating? Is it continuous? And for that, we tend to be driven more by the sort of financial characteristics. So a very disruptive company typically has a high, like a premium valuation multiple. An accelerating innovator typically has high growth, so whether that's sales or earnings. And a more incremental innovator is usually the sort of consistently high return on capital. We then also go through a more qualitative assessment, which is very subjective, and we hold our hands up for that, to try and analyze, you know, what part of the company is innovative. Is it science or technology? Is it a product or a service? Is it the business model? You know, how important is innovation to the company management? Is this a company that's designing its own products, or is it a company that's bringing something that already exists to market in a better way? And ultimately, that is a discussion that Matt and I have. And what we find is that normally, from our investable universe, most of the companies are innovative, or they fit within our matrix, if you like. But ultimately, sometimes, if you get a company, like you would say, like a monopoly, you might say, well, actually, it's not, you know, why is its return on capital very good? Well, it's not because it's innovative, it's because it doesn't have any competition whatsoever. And ultimately, you know, I'd imagine most monopolistic companies are actually the least likely to be innovative because they don't need to be.
Right.
So therefore, it's difficult. So what we're saying is, if it's hard to get in our matrix, or we find it hard to place that company, then we won't buy it for the portfolio. And I would say, you know, finding a company with high return on capital and monopoly advantage might not be a bad investment. We would just say it's not one for our portfolio. And I would suggest that the risk you run with buying one of those companies is that it actually no longer becomes monopolistic because new regulatory rules come in or something, and actually you'll find that what you bought is actually not very valuable. But that's our process. So it's investable universe, broadly speaking, innovative. We then narrow it down to see, are they innovative or not, by our own metrics. And then it's a matter of, do we understand the company? Do we think it's good value versus its peers, the broad market? And what growth is baked into the price?
Okay. And do you have any sense about, because this line of question had started with the simple observation, all of your competitors want to buy these same companies. Why do you succeed and they don't?
I think one key part for us, I think, is, you know, we don't follow trends. We're not thematic in the way that we invest in this. We're very objective, and I think we've been very keen to avoid getting sucked into exciting narratives or exciting stories or, you know, areas of great media interest and excitement. And, you know, both of us, as our university education was to study physics, so you know, we tend to quite like numbers more than stories, and so I think that's kind of helped us a little bit in terms of trying to get some sort of objectivity. I mean, what we get excited about is when we see high quality companies that are trading on attractive valuations because they are for some reason temporarily out of favor.
Mm-hmm.
But where we can still believe in a sort of long-term growth trend. And for that, you have to be very patient. You know, you have to, you know, we have to go and sit in front of investors and they say to us, well, you know, why have you bought this company that's, you know, that looks really quite scary and out of favor and, you know, there's no great story behind it. And we just, you know, it all comes back to return on capital and valuation. You know, I think when you boil it down statistically, quality and value is what will ultimately drive returns, and stories and themes, you know, will not. And I think that's a big part of our success.
Okay. I was wondering, too, if you had any sense about whether the fact that you're physically not located near your competitors has an advantage to you. That is, you're sort of isolated, I would imagine, from whatever the informal buzz in New York or Boston or L.A. is. And I didn't know if you had a sense of kind of value in just the sheer geographic difference.
I'm not sure I'd put too much on that, to be honest. I've never been to Silicon Valley, for example, but I hear it's very nice this time of year, so you never know, maybe I will. But I don't think that makes a huge difference. I mean, obviously, we're based in London, which is also another, you know, very large financial centre. So, you know, the City of London, we see all sorts of IPOs and companies visiting and, you know, all the brokers chatting about this, that or the other. So, you know, in that sense, from the sort of, I guess, from a sort of technology point of view, we're probably fairly far away, if you like. But from just a markets point of view, I think we're pretty plugged in if we want to be. I think it's just one of the things we like to do is to be slightly removed from that and try and, because that helps you focus on the fundamentals.
Okay.
I mean, one of the things we have is, you know, the brokers from the investment banks are always ringing up with the latest story, because ultimately if they can tell you a good story, then hopefully that will make you trade. You give them that trade, they make their commission, et cetera, et cetera. And we got to the stage over the last few years where we've encouraged the brokers not to ring us up anymore because we're not very interested. And just say, look, you know, if you've got something interesting to say, I'll you know, send me the report and I'll take a look. But I'm not interested in spending my afternoons chatting back and forth with someone who's really just trying to make me do something,
right?
Regardless of whether that's buying or selling.
So does that imply you don't buy external stock research?
We do have access to sort of the broker research, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
We really tend to use it not for buy and sell recommendations, but, you know, some of the analysts are a bit closer to the companies for more technical questions. And also, it's very good to you know, we run our own models, we do our own analysis. But what's quite good is to maybe get an opinion that's very different to yours, and that's somehow where we use the research. So if we're very keen on a company, you know, maybe we'll go and get some research that seems very negative on it and just try and kick around why they think that's the case and have we missed anything.
Okay, cool. As some of the folks listening know, you are actually the third set of managers to run the Global Innovators Fund. And I didn't know if you would take just a minute to kind of walk through, because when we look at claims like it's got the best record of any global multi-cap over the last 15 years. And the reality is, well, you weren't there 15 years ago, nor was the strategy, and likewise the best record over the last 10. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the evolution of the strategy from its inception and to today?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, it's got a quite an unusual history, but it's fairly straightforward. So the fund was initially launched back in 1998. And it was originally designed to be a passive fund that was going to track Wired Magazine's top 40 companies. And, you know, they were looking, it was all at the sort of beginning of the dot-com boom, and you know, the fund went up and down with the market in those types of companies. And then what happened in 2003 was that fund was bought by our chief investment officer and CEO, Tim Guinness and Jim Atkinson, to form, you know, one of the pillars of Guinness Atkinson from the company that they both worked at previously, which was Guinness Flight. And the first thing they did when they bought this fund was they converted it to an active fund and changed the name to the Global Innovators Fund. And the philosophy of the fund has been exactly the same since 2003 when they took over that fund. So I think you can see the 10-year track record certainly as being essentially relevant the entire time. So I then joined the firm, this is Matt, in 2005, and I've been working on the fund ever since. So initially I joined as an analyst. And in many ways, the way you know we at Guinness Atkinson look at companies, you know, rubbed off on me from working alongside Tim Guinness, a very experienced fund manager. So the philosophy of looking for these innovative companies, for having a 30 stock portfolio that was equally weighted, that had low turnover, that had a value discipline, those things have all been consistent for at least the last 10 years, effectively nearly, you know, 11 or 12 years now. And then essentially Tim Guinness stepped off running the fund in around 2011. Ian and I had been working together on this fund and our other fund, the Global Dividend Strategy, since 2010. Effectively we now have a 5-year track record on this fund.
Mm-hmm. Great. I thought what I would do, if it makes sense, is invite Jamie to explain to our listeners how they could ask a question of you folks. After he does that, I'll run through one last question of my own, and then we'll turn the lines over to them. Jamie,
sure.
Are you there?
Absolutely. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one. To withdraw your question, you may press star and two. If you're using a speakerphone, we do ask that you please pick up your handset before pressing the keys to ensure the best sound quality. Again, that is star and then one to ask a question.
And so I was curious about what would lead you to sell a stock. The argument you'd made is that you're looking for companies that have, at least in the case of the second category, the continuous improvement firms, at least a decade of success, but you don't typically hold companies for a decade. You talked about 3 to 5 years. Is it because they lose, by and large, because they lose their kind of focus, key people leave, or merely they become too pricey for you to be comfortable still holding them?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think, you know, there's a number of reasons why we may potentially sell a company. I think one of the biggest drivers is valuation. What we find is, you know, our holding period of 3 to 5 years has just been typically over the last 10 years the type of holding period on average we've had for companies. But within that, you know, we have sold companies over 1 year. So, you know, example we had that did very well was Shire, the pharmaceutical company we bought back end of last year. And we sold that within about 8 months because the bid came in for it, the stock re-rated, and we made about 80%. Therefore, the valuation's too much, so we sold it. You know, mm-hmm. Other companies, it may be that you have to be patient, as Matt said, for that value to come through, for the market to recognize some of the things that we'd recognized in that company. And really, that's the main driver for us. Other things, though, we're obviously conscious of is, if you think of that second group, as you were discussing, is that those companies are no longer maintain that high return on capital. So we start to see a return on capital profile that starts to decrease. So what we find is that if a company has that 10-year record of top quartile return on capital, we find that on probability-wise, there's a very high chance it will continue to do so. So if you make that cut, there's about a 95% chance that in year 11, you'll continue to have that top quartile return on capital. And there's about an 80% chance 4 years hence, you continue to have that high return on capital. But like you say, if we're holding a company over that period and we start to see that return on capital profile decrease, we would take that as an indicator that the company is maybe no longer being innovative, no longer being able to maintain its market share or its margins or whatever it might be, and that would be an indicator for us to then exit that position, because we again are driven by that return on capital decreasing can be an indicator that, you know, this company is in decline, and could be a reason to sell. Okay. Other things we might sell a company for would be a sort of change in capital budgeting approach, for example. So examples would be, you know, here's a company that's been growing organically for a long time. All of a sudden it switches to actually making lots of acquisitions to be able to grow. And that might be an indicator that you say, well, hang on a minute, you know, this is a company maybe changing or a company struggling to grow. Or it might be companies taking on too much debt, for example, or becoming too leveraged, therefore too risky. All those things would filter in terms of why we might exit a position.
Okay, great. Jamie, I didn't know if there were folks who had questions.
Yes, sir. We do have two or three folks that would like to ask a question. Our first question comes from Jim Pursley. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, gentlemen. This is Jim Pursley with Gaia Capital Management. I have a question about how your strategy and tactics and your analytical and portfolio management methodology has evolved over time. And the corollary is, how have mistakes informed the development of this strategy and tactics?
Sure. Thanks for the question, Jim. In terms of the way the investment process has evolved, it's a good question. And it has done exactly that. It has evolved, but it has not sort of radically changed. And I think part of that's been just the availability of and the ease of extracting the sort of quantitative data that we want is a lot easier now than it was 10 years ago. And I think that has allowed us to potentially be more objective than we were 10 years ago. I think, as Ian sort of alluded to earlier, the sort of emphasis on meeting the management of companies that we have invested in has become less important to us. I think that's something, I guess, partly that we have learned by making mistakes. You know, I think we would certainly hold our hands up and say over the last 10 years there have been examples of companies we've invested in where we've slightly been sucked in by a great story from management. it's difficult to remain objective when you are, you know, hearing the great stories of how this company is going to grow. You know, no manager is going to turn around and tell you what his five biggest fears are, you know, even if you ask him. So I think that's one part of it. And the other thing is that in terms of mistakes is that, you know, we've developed a model for analyzing companies that is constantly evolving. And when we sell any company that we have bought, what we do is we go back and look at the entire history of how that total return has been produced. So we break down that total return into price change, we break it down into multiple expansion, earnings growth, the dividend yield and the dividend growth, and we also look at share buybacks. And you know, we compare that to what we expected when we originally bought the company. And we try to look, see whether we got that right. Did we get it right for the wrong reasons? So effectively, did we get a bit lucky? Or did we simply just get it wrong? And we try to learn from that and go away and think about, okay, how could we stop that type of mistake happening again? How could we build that into our due diligence process? How could we build that into our the modeling that we do? And, you know, that is a very important part of keeping our investment process sort of sharp and up to date, if you like.
Great, thanks. May I ask another question?
Quickly.
Great. Can you describe how you divide your analytical and portfolio management labor between the two of you?
Sure, yeah. We very much do it sort of on a 50-50 basis. You know, in terms of sort of Guinness Atkinson, you know, we have typically we have more than one manager on each fund. That's something that we've sort of had over time. You know, we find that, you know, do committees make good decisions? Probably not. But I think the two of us, what we've done is we've, you know, ultimately we do half the work and we both have, if you like, a veto on buy and sell decisions. But one of the things we've been sort of, we've grown up on, if you like, in terms of working together is that, you know, we have very much thought about the types of companies we'd like to buy, whether it's for the more growth-oriented innovators fund or whether it's for the more dividend-oriented dividend builder fund. And in such a way that we're both sort of running in parallel, if you like. Yeah, and the debates we're having are very much around you know, valuations and what the company's doing and maybe prospects rather than the types of company we should be buying. So in that sense, we're very, you know, it becomes very helpful, I think, to have another person looking at it. And it also can potentially show you, you know, when you've got more conviction. You know, if we're both sort of coming in and getting extremely worried about a certain, you know, certain stock, then potentially that helps you make that decision more sort of expediently, which could actually be a better thing. But to your point, we don't make anything. You know, it's not like I do telcos and Matt does energy and all that sort of stuff. You know, we both do. So we both cover sort of all market caps and all sectors.
We call it a collaborative model then.
Absolutely.
Great.
Thank you, Jim. Jamie, do we have other folks waiting?
Yes, sir. We have an additional question from David Hubbard. Please go ahead with your question.
Yeah, hi, gentlemen. Great presentation, and in fact, it's very gratifying for me. I am a shareholder in your main fund and put in a substantial position about a month ago. You guys sound like you're vigorous and youthful, and I'm a long-term type of person. I'm not particularly young, but I'm very vigorous. Do you guys plan to be in the business for a long time? Perhaps you might want to address that a little bit.
Yeah, David, well, thank you very much for your investments. It's very much appreciated. Yeah, we're very much in this for the long run. We're both in our early 30s. I certainly consider myself sort of at the early stage of my career. You know, we'll look to, you know, hopefully be running this fund still in, you know, 20, 30 years' time. I mean, Tim Guinness was running this portfolio until his mid-60s, and I don't see any reason why we couldn't as well.
The other thing I might point out is that in terms of the Guinness Atkinson business, you know, Matt and I both own equity in the business. So, again, that sort of helps us be more aligned from both, you know, the sort of fund point of view and also the company point of view.
I know... if you give me just a second, Dave, to follow up, folks had also wondered if you invest in the strategy or how you invest in the strategy yourselves.
Yeah, unfortunately, for the U.S. fund, we don't own a U.S. passport, so we're not allowed to invest in the in IWIRX. But in terms of the strategy, we have recently launched a sister product, so sort of a fund run in parallel, that is actually registered in Dublin, so which allows European investors to gain access to the strategy. And so we're just waiting for that to get set up on a couple of platforms, and then both Matt and I will be able to invest our pensions in that fund.
Okay. I'm sorry, David. Had I cut you off, sir?
David, not really. I just one other really quick question. Gentlemen, I don't have the privilege of being British. My wife, in fact, is British, but and this might get you into dangerous waters, but do you see any particular differences, so we say culturally and in maybe the London investment culture versus maybe the New York investment culture? My wife certainly sees some differences. And, of course, she feels they're very much to the favor of the Brits.
bias, I think I would describe that as. I don't know, if I was being rude, people probably think we're cleverer than we are by our accents. But I'd say generally no. I mean, I think, you know, we are very much, we would describe ourselves as value investors. And I think you could find good examples of value investors on, you know, on both sides of the pond. And I think absolutely we would, you know, we wouldn't say we had a huge advantage by being British whatsoever, I don't think.
Great. Jamie, other folks?
Yes, sir. We have two additional questions. Our first question comes from Doug Rounsley. Please go ahead with your question.
Yes, hello. I'm a private investor in Lexington, Kentucky. Which are your favorite sectors? In which countries are you invested? And how do you discover superior management?
Yeah, so, I mean, we, I suppose, given we run an equally weighted portfolio, you know, we tend not to let ourselves prefer one stock over another in our fund. You know, I think that's the sort of good thing about equally weighting them. I think often as fund managers, your supposed best idea is sometimes your last idea. And, you know, we like to sort of restrict ourselves from, you know, wanting to add a huge weight to the last idea that we've had in the fund. So, you know, in terms of, you know, favorite sectors, I mean, we have been overweight the IT sector, and we've been overweight a little bit the US relative to a global benchmark. And, you know, really what we've found there is sort of, and in that IT area, it hasn't really been in the sort of small or mid-cap space. It tends to be in the more the larger cap space. So, you know, we've owned things like Xerox and, as Ian mentioned earlier, Cisco and Intel. And I guess they're all sort of, you know, a group of companies that, you know, may be transitioning from a sort of historically a sort of really, well, not a very rapid growth phase, but a sort of, you know, a fairly decent growth phase into a more sort of sustainable, you know, and low growth phase. But, you know, growth that is profitable, that is attractive, and most importantly for us, at very attractive valuations. So, you know, and even though, you know, US IT performed pretty well last year, we were still adding positions there at the end of the year because we continue to find, you know, attractive opportunities. And, you know, in terms of the other sort of geographical, you know, bias, you know, we tended to find more innovative companies in the US than we have anywhere else in the world. But the balance of the portfolio is pretty much evenly split between, you know, Europe and Asia.
Great, thank you. Jamie, are there other questions?
We have a final question from Edward Stasinski. Please go ahead with your question.
How do you distinguish between the great company, great business at a fair price, and the kind of good company available at a bargain price when you're making investment decisions?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I'm trying to just think on my feet about how best to answer that. I think it would also, it would come into quite a lot. I mean, we don't tend to run, you know, we don't tend to try and come up with sort of target prices, for example. You know, so in that case, you know, if you did, then I guess you could argue, well, you know, good, a great company at a reasonable price, that's 20% upside. You know, here's a good company at a cheap price, that's also 20% upside. Which one's better? I think, you know, that's not what we're about. What we're about is trying to say, you know, I think I want to find a cheap company, whether that's cheap relative to its peers, cheap relative to the broad market, or cheap relative to where that company has traded historically. You know, we'd ideally like to see companies that tick all three of those boxes, but they're very hard to find. And what I would say is that for us, it's the element of quality. And by that quality, we define it as that sort of high return on capital, or persistently high return on capital, or a return on capital that's growing. And I think we would try and focus more on the companies with the sort of the better quality, if you like. So that sort of, I'd rather have a great company at a reasonable value than a good company at a super cheap valuation, if that makes sense. Because I think the risk to the good company, the risk is less, if you like. There's a better margin of safety on the great company, because I believe their return on capital profile will be maintained. And I think that's really where we come from. And in terms of, you know, as Matt said earlier on in the call, where's our total return going to come from? It's going to be sort of operational growth, sort of that sort of sales growth, margin improvement, or earnings growth. It's going to be multiple expansion, so companies that cheap that's getting re-rated, or it's going to come from sort of dividend and dividend growth. They're the three things we try and focus on and try and analyze. And obviously, when you're trying to see whether the company is cheap or expensive, it may be cheap on one of those metrics or all three, or where's your return going to come from? And what we tend to do is that for obviously our dividend fund, we're focusing more on that dividend and dividend growth and making sure we've definitely got that. And on the growth fund and the innovators fund, we're focusing potentially a little bit more on that growth profile. But we definitely want for both our strategies, though, is that valuation, sort of the potential for re-rating to be there on both sides. And I think that's the sort of thing that sort of links the two together. And I hope that sort of answers your question, in that the quality of the business is something we look for at all times, if you like.
But has it become harder to identify those kinds of companies in the vacuum, not given your amount of assets under management, but given the huge amounts of capital sloshing around globally looking for homes, where so many people, the ability to find that undervalued idea and invest in it, used to be you could accumulate a position over months and then weeks and then days, and now oftentimes it's an hour or two in the morning if you're lucky.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that identifying high-quality companies with attractive valuations is harder today than it was, say, 3 or 4 years ago. Back in the end of 2010, there were very obviously some very high-quality, bargain stocks out there. But today they do still exist, and I think we just have to be willing to go where there is negative sentiment, crucially negative sentiment that we think is temporary in nature. In our dividend fund, that took us into pharmaceutical stocks in 2010 when everyone was particularly focused, so they've always been focused on it, but particularly focused on the patent cliff. It took us into U.S. defense stocks in the end of 2012, beginning of 2013, when there was all the concerns regarding the sort of fiscal cliff in the U.S. And then more recently, it's taken us a little bit into Asia and Europe, where there are deep concerns. Now, if we can find businesses that we know have got a long track record of consistently high return on capital, that we statistically feel pretty confident that these companies are going to continue to earn those high returns on capital, then those are the sort of examples we can still buy today. But trying to figure out whether the concern that the market has on a particular company is justified or not is really the key element to that. And, we also would say that we're not always going to get them all right. We will, happily hold our hands up and say we're not always going to be right on these. But we think if we keep looking for these companies that, there's something potentially temporary that's holding down that valuation, then they can be a great opportunity. And again, I think that fits in, really strongly with the narrative. I think a lot of people think a quality company is a company that they've heard of or they know or is large or has a great brand or is in the consumer staple or pharmaceutical sector. And it isn't. Objectively, it could be much broader than that. And, there's a company in the UK you may have heard of called Tesco that was kind of held up as it's a supermarket, and it was held up as a sort of absolute, darling of the UK PLC, if you like, or UK companies. And when you look at it through the objective eye of the company's historic return on capital, it's been fading for the last 10 years. And, this company's share price has taken an absolute battering over the last 12 months or so. So it really is back to that quality and value. But yes, today it is certainly harder, but we are still finding opportunities.
But you would rather find them and invest than let the cash build up?
We would, yeah. We will remain fully invested.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, Ed. Guys, we have just a couple minutes left. We hadn't at all talked about your second fund. I know the recently renamed Dividend Builder Fund has very few assets for a fund with its track record. Some of our readers had some concern about whether the fund would stay around or how long you folks would be able to subsidize its existence. And I did know if you'd take a minute just to kind of walk us through the story of the second fund.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the first thing I'll say, just to point out, is that as a business, you know, we run U.S. mutual funds, and we also run Dublin-based funds for European investors. So, you know, it's basically European investors can't buy U.S. mutual funds and vice versa. So a lot of the strategies we run as a business have mirror funds. As I say, you know,
okay,
we have a global innovator in the U.S. And what I would say in terms of our dividend strategy, it's actually a strategy we've been running for over 4 years now in our Dublin range. And that fund has about $120 million in.
Okay.
We then launched a mirror version just under 3 years ago, March 31st. In the United States, and that has, as you say, about $6 million. But the strategy itself has about $126 million,
okay,
so it'd be unlikely that we're thinking about closing it. So that's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is that the idea for that, for this Dividend Builder Fund, came about through Matt and myself. So we were the ones, we very much designed it, came up with the process, portfolio construction, stocks we bought, everything from day one to today. And where it came about was, you know, Tim Guinness, our CIO, essentially challenged us to come up with new fund ideas so we could build up the range of our business and grow our business. And we thought, you know, how can we come up, you know, we're running a growth fund, a Global Innovators Fund. Let's think about a value fund. You know, what's the best way of doing a value fund? We think we found a good way to do growth. What has a good way of thinking of value? And what we kind of came up with was actually looking at those more sort of incremental, so those group two type companies, those high return on capital, multi-year periods. And we sort of tweaked out a little bit, and what we found is when we analysed those, that we found, you know, good quality companies and also companies that tend quite often paid a dividend. So what we thought is we'd focus more on those, with some tweaks to do with debt to equity. We have slightly more diversification rules in the fund, etc. And that made the basis of our investable universe. And that we then went through, so we still run it in the same way, very similarly, in the sense that it has a 35-stock portfolio. It's equally weighted. We buy and hold, so the holding period, 3 to 5 years. We really focus more on dividend growth. So we are not holding ourselves out to be a high-yield fund. We actually think that's a very poor way of investing for income from equities. We have a moderate yield, so it's probably running at 3.1%, 3.2%. And we like to grow the income stream organically over time. I think typically we've grown it maybe sort of between 4 and 5% year on year. That's what we think is the best approach, because if you can get a company that's reasonable value, got a reasonable yield, the yield's too high, it could be quite risky. If you've got a moderate yield that's safe and that we can grow that income stream, we think that can help sort of drag up the share price, if you like, over time. And it's that sort of income and growth is what we do.
Okay.
The other thing I would say is I'll put in a plug that if anyone wants more information on that, if you go to our website is gafunds.com, and we've got some white papers on why dividends matter and some other bits and bobs about the fund if anyone was interested.
Great. I'd like to thank Matthew and Ian and you all for your time today. I'll make a few notes in closing. One of those is that profiles of both of the funds in question are available at the Mutual Fund Observer. Just click on the tab that said Funds. A recording of this call and an audio profile of the Global Innovators Fund will be available at the Observer in our March issue. Highlights of this call and an MP3 link to its content will be posted on our discussion board, to which you're all invited, sometime in the next 48 hours. And we will try to continue these conversations in the months ahead, next with former hedge fund manager David Berkowitz, founding partner of Gotham Partners, and with Lock-In April, with Andrew Foster, founding manager of Seafarer Overseas Growth and Income, which will at that point be celebrating its third anniversary, and a likely continued snub from the good people at Morningstar. In the interim, thank you, gentlemen. It was very kind of you to stay with us and to share so generously of your time.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, David.
And thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's conference call. We do thank you for attending. You may now disconnect your telephone lines.